In 1974, Kentucky Fried Chicken launched a big ad campaign for the Christmas season in Japan. Now, Christmas is not a national holiday in Japan, not the big thing that is here, but KFC decided they do have some acknowledgement of the Christmas season. They thought they would capitalize on it there in Japan. And so they had a simple slogan on this campaign, Kurisumasu Niwa Kentucky, which translates to Kentucky for Christmas. That was the big deal. So get Kentucky Fried Chicken for Christmas. That was their motto. Somehow that caught on. And so to this day in Japan, families all over Japan head to the local KFC for a special Christmas Eve meal of fried chicken. It's a tradition now in Japan. Go figure. In Caracas, Venezuela, somehow it has become a tradition to roller skate to morning mass on Christmas morning. And it's gotten to be such a big thing that they actually have to close streets to traffic so that the people can get to the morning mass on Christmas morning in their roller skates. I have no idea where that came from. In 1958, television was pretty new. In Sweden, there were only two channels in the whole country. One of those channels showed a cartoon special titled Kalle Anka och Hans Vanner Önskar Gott Jul. And that translates to Donald Duck and his friends wish you a Merry Christmas. The weird thing is, that has become a thing. And so in Sweden now, every Christmas, 3 p.m. and Christmas afternoon, they show that cartoon, and the whole country's Christmas celebration revolves around that cartoon show. I don't know why. In the Ukraine, the tradition is to decorate their Christmas trees with fake spider webs. That's a little creepy, don't you think? But there's more creepy. In Austria, there is a St. Nick has an evil sort of opposite whose name is Krampus. And Krampus supposedly wanders the streets in search of badly behaved children. And so during the Christmas season, the month of December, people can expect to see terrifying masked Krampus figures out and about pulling pranks and scaring kids. Merry Christmas. You know, around the world, it just, you know, people have a lot of strange traditions in the world, like, you know, watching sappy Hallmark movies nonstop as, you know. Yeah, I know. Yeah, okay, see what I mean? Yeah. Well, I think it's actually not, it probably shouldn't be surprising that Christmas has a lot of strange traditions around the world because Christmas itself has some very strange elements. And this morning, we're going to look at one of the strangest, to me, certainly the most violent. But there's an important message in this. And this, we had been studying, as you all know, if you've been with us, studying spiritual warfare. And last week and this week, we're looking at the intersection of spiritual warfare and Christmas. Because Christmas is where the spiritual warfare actually broke out in the physical world. So this morning we're going to look at Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 18. It says, you know what? I gave you the wrong... Chapter 2 is what that should be. I think I gave you the wrong verses, but I have it here on my phone, so it's okay. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw a star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly, found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for this child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go worship him." Yeah. After they heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. He gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time that he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." So what we see here is the Magi came looking for the king. They went to Herod and asked where the baby was. This, we're told, disturbed Herod and the entire city of Jerusalem. So raises the question, the Magi, who are they? You know, sometimes they're called wise men. You know, then there's the song, you know, "We three kings of Orient are," you know, that whole thing. Kings, wise men, Magi. Who were they? And why were they coming to Israel in the first place, to Palestine? Most of us know something about them, but I want to give you a little bit more background on them. The Greek word we see rendered magi was actually the word magoi, was the plural of the word magos, which was derived, it's a Greek word that was derived from an earlier Persian word, magu. Wait, Mr. Magoo was involved? No, nothing to do with Mr. Magoo. Actually, that no one has been able to discover any particular meaning for the word magu other than it refers to this particular group of people, the Magi. They were an ancient group that existed centuries before Christ. They were prominent first in the Babylonian and then the Medo-Persian and then the Parthian empires were there in all of those. They were some of the most educated and intelligent people in their culture of that day. They studied science, philosophy, religion. Interestingly, early on, they seemed to have little or no theology in the earliest forms that we can find. But around the 6th century BC, Zoroastrianism became sort of the predominant religion in the Babylonian Empire, and the Magi gravitated towards that. Now, Zoroastrianism, actually, the Zoroastrians exalted an uncreated benevolent deity of wisdom they called Ahura Mazda. Zoroastrians, there are still some around today. In fact, there are some actually in our area. It's a religion that has some parallels with Judaism, you know, with, for instance, the one uncreated God. And they had some similar practices, animal sacrifices that were parallel to Judaism. So there was a little bit of a parallel between the two religions. One feature of the Magi that was not parallel in Judaism was they were heavily into astrology and dream interpretation and other occult practices. Part of the reason for this was that they studied science. And at that point in human history, science was thought to include occult ideas because they were just trying to figure out how the world works. And they thought maybe the stars affected us and, you know, maybe the occult works. So we tend to look down on that with some, you know, they were superstitious. They believed all those things. But it would probably be wise for us to remember these were some of the smartest people on the planet. And they were probably as smart or smarter than the smartest people on the planet today. They just didn't have as much information as we do today. And it would be helpful for us to remember that if the world continues long enough, there will come times when people will look back on our culture and be amazed at how superstitious and how dumb we were. The things that we believe now that we think are the latest in science will prove to be not true. My senior year in high school, I had a class in physics. And our teacher required that each of us in the class do a presentation for the class. You know what? I can't even remember what I did. And I can't even remember what anybody else did except for one. There was one presentation one of the students made. He was one of the smartest guys in our school. And he did this presentation. I remember because at the time it seemed like such a strange idea. And his presentation said that it had to do with the buildup of gases in our atmosphere caused by pollutants and the use of carbon fuels. And he reported that many scientists at that point were increasingly concerned that this was going to ultimately cause some serious and potentially damaging change in climate around the world. I remember hearing that and thinking, well, that's just the strangest thing I've ever heard. We hear a lot about that now, don't we? Oh, but I should probably tell you about the change they were concerned about. They were concerned that the pollution was going to block sunlight and lead to global cooling. So much so that they were concerned about another ice age occurring. Now, I want you to realize that, you know, that's been a long time, but it's not like I'm 500 years old, you know. That was in my lifetime, and now people look back on that and think, well, that was stupid. Well, that was the epitome of science at that time. And now we think, oh, no, that wasn't right. It wasn't even close. It was the wrong direction altogether, they say. All of which to say, when you think back on these men, you need to think of them as brilliant people because that is what they were. But what about that song, We Three Kings? Why do they call them kings? Glad you asked. It's because they became politically powerful. The Persian Empire eventually kind of devolved into the Parthian Empire. The Parthian Empire was where, at the time of Christ, these magi came from. They were... The Parthian Empire had a ruling group that consisted of two houses, kind of like our Congress. Well, the upper house, the more powerful of the two, consisted solely of magi. So they were a politically powerful group. They would be kind of like our Senate, except they had more power because they were the ones that determined who would be named the next king of the Parthian Empire. So they were literally kingmakers. So they were powerful, really intelligent men. How did they happen to come to Palestine looking for a king who had been born? Well, the roots of that actually go back quite a number of centuries, all the way back to the 6th century BC. There was a very powerful magi whose name was Belteshazzar. He was so wise that he was eventually named the chief of the magi, the head magi. You've heard of him by another name. Turns out he was Hebrew, and you know him by the name of Daniel. Daniel was a magi. In fact, he was named the lead magi in the country. So you will remember that Daniel had some friends who were also trained along with him, Jewish people. So there were a number of Jewish magi, and it's quite likely that the prophecies of the prophets of Israel were communicated to the magi by Daniel and his friends. Certainly would have come from Daniel, who has some remarkable prophecies. It's interesting that we know that there was heightened expectation in Israel of the coming of Messiah about the time that Christ was born. Interestingly, history gives us some hints that there was actually a broader sense of that as well. The Roman historian Suetonius reported that there was a general belief around that time that a great leader was about to be born. For the Magi, they knew. They were very specific because they had Daniel's prophecies. They knew that a king was going to be born in Israel, and Daniel in Daniel 9 had given a timeline. They knew about the time that the Messiah, this king, was supposed to be born. So they were looking for him. We read that they told Herod, "We saw his star when it rose." Well, the reason they saw it was they were looking for it. Remember, they were astrologers / astronomers. In their day, they were the same. So they were men who studied the stars. So they were looking in the heavens for some sign, some indication that this great leader, this Messiah, had been born. What was the sign? You know what? We really don't know. There are theories that you'll hear every now and then that it, excuse me, was some sort of alignment of stars or planets that it might have been, you know, people who were into astronomy or astrology were looking for. I think that's probably not quite right, because in the passage it says at one point the star stopped over the place where Jesus was, which that doesn't seem to fit. So my guess, and it's just a guess, is that it was some sort of phenomenon, probably some, maybe a supernatural phenomenon, but not as obvious or marked as you would see in most Christmas cards, you know, with the big, bright, shining star, you know. It was probably just some anomaly that they noticed and said, well, this is unusual. This shouldn't be there. This is probably the sign that Messiah has been born. Now, so the Magi, they see this sign and they head to Israel to honor the king who has been born. Now, it's not mentioned in the chapter, but I'm pretty sure they brought their wives along with them. And I know that because when they get to Palestine, they stopped and asked for directions. And what guy is going to do that unless his wife is saying, I'm tired of being lost, stop and get some directions here. So they stop and they ask Herod, where do we go to find the Messiah? Herod's an interesting guy. Herod is a very controversial guy in history in a lot of ways. He did a lot of really good things. He had some amazing building projects for Israel. He built the temple, the great temple in Jerusalem. But Herod, though he was the ruler, the king of the Jews, he actually was not ethnically Jewish himself. His mother was, but his father was an Edomite. And Herod claimed to have converted to Judaism, but his lifestyle gave no indication whatsoever that he obeyed or practiced any part of Judaism. He did it in name only because he wanted to be the king of the Jews. He wasn't the king of the Jews because he was an heir to the title or because the Jewish people chose him as their king. He was the heir. He was the king of the Jews because the Romans were ruling and they said, this guy's in charge. He's king over you. And the people hated him. They hated him because he wasn't fully Jewish. They hated him because he was really a Roman lackey. And they hated him because he was just generally an awful person. He was really a miserable human being. Particularly as he got near the end of his life, he became irrationally violent. The people only tolerated him because they had to. It was the power of Rome that kept him in place. Now, when the Magi showed up asking about a king who had been born, both Herod, it says, and the entire city of Jerusalem were disturbed. Why? Well, easy to understand why Herod was disturbed. If there's actually a legitimate heir to the throne of Israel who's been born, and the people hate Herod, what is he afraid is going to happen? People are going to back this new king, this baby child king, and they're going to revolt against Herod. There's going to be an uprising against him. One of the things we need to remember about dictators, tyrants, despots, they almost always end badly. Have you noticed that in history? Their lives, it's not like, okay, they leave office and then they go on to have a career like, you know, writing books and speaking every place. They die when they get kicked out of office. They're assassinated almost always. Herod understood that. And he understood that there's somebody who could come and replace me. I'm going to be killed. Couldn't handle that. So he's very disturbed. But why is the city disturbed? Interesting question. Here's why I think they were disturbed. We think of Rome as this monolithic superpower of the day. And it was clearly the preeminent superpower of the first century. But it wasn't monolithic. It had rivals, and one of those was the Parthian Empire. In fact, in 55 BC, There was a Roman army of about 50,000 that was sent into the Palestine, Asia Minor area to basically conquer some of the territory and control it. And at one point, they were opposed by a Parthian army. The Parthian army, pretty remarkably, was only 10,000 in number. It was actually initially intended to be just a kind of a recon and force, and then maybe have a little delaying action. But the commander of the Parthian group decided, after the initial skirmishes, he thought they could take the Romans. And so full-on battle ensued, and the Parthians just decimated that Roman army. They killed somewhere between 20 and 30,000 of them and captured 10,000 of them. There was not much left. And the Parthians only suffered minor, light casualties. It was a total humiliating defeat for the Romans, the worst defeat they had suffered up to that point. Parthians were not to be trifled with. In 40 BC, just a few decades before these events, they actually invaded Palestine and took over. They defeated the Romans and took over control of Jerusalem and Judea and all of that area. Romans later came back and wrested control back. But the Parthians, you know, they weren't, they were not a minor group. And so here's the thing. The when the Magi show up, you know, we tend to think of them as, you know, there's three kings. Where do we get that number? Well, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, right? Three gifts, must have been three kings. Wrong. Those were the kinds of gifts they gave, but there were probably a lot more of them. Could have been the entire Senate came. There was a bunch of them. And they would have traveled with servants and attendants, oh, and their wives, of course, we know. You know. They also would have been accompanied by a very large security force, at least a company of soldiers. So you can imagine, you're in Jerusalem, and all of a sudden, this huge caravan arrives of powerful people with an armed force from a country that's a nation that's a rival to Rome. What are you thinking? What does this mean? What is going to happen? Is this a precursor to an invasion? They're asking about a king. Are they coming to set up some sort of alliance to overthrow the Romans and Herod? A lot of discussion started happening because of the arrival of these people. So they come and they find out where the king is and they go. And what do they do when they get there? Well, the Magi worshiped the king. You know, Herod had no idea about where a king was, so he asked the experts, and they told him, Micah 5:2, he's going to be born in Bethlehem. That's where he is. Isn't it interesting that they knew that and didn't do anything about it? Pretty strange. We'll see why in a few moments. But Herod says, well, you go there, and when you find the baby, then tell me so I can come and worship him too. What a bunch of lies. They headed to Bethlehem, found the baby, and it says they worshiped him. You know, the typical manger scene, you see, we have one at our house. You know, there's the stable and the baby in the manger and Joseph and Mary, and there's the animals, and then there's the shepherds, and there's the Magi, and that's all wrong. It's mostly right, but the Magi wouldn't have been there when the shepherds were there. The Magi came months later. Shepherds were long gone. The baby was no longer in the stable. The baby was now living in a house someplace with his mom and dad by the time the Magi got there. So just the details. Everyone, so change your manger scene, you know. No, I'm just kidding. Just want you to understand. This happened quite a bit later than when the Magi, than the night Jesus was born. But it says they worshiped him. You know that? They bowed down and they worshiped a baby. Fairly amazing. You know, how much did they know about that baby? Well, I don't think they had the full picture. In fact, I'm certain they didn't have the full picture. But they did understand this child was more than just another human being. They understood that heaven somehow was involved in the arrival of this child, that this child had some connection with the divine. And the appropriate response was to worship him. How do you worship a baby? You know, we have a baby in our extended family. And you might think he's worshipped when you watch how he's treated by his parents and his grandparents, you know. I mean, if he is unhappy about anything, his wishes are catered to, you know. Hungry, feed him. Crying because he's got a dirty diaper, change him, you know. If he wants to be held, hold him. And amazing thing about the little baby in our family, little Wesley, somehow, I mean, he's 3 months old, he knows if who's holding him, whether they're standing up or sitting down, and he wants them to be standing up. So, you know, I'm crying, or he's crying, you hold him, and he's still crying, and he will keep crying until you stand up and do this thing. You know, okay, that's fine. And then you get him quiet, and you sit down, and we're back up again, you know. So, you know, but wait a minute, is he worshipped? No, he's loved, he's adored, but he's not worshipped. But that baby was worshipped. They were, by bowing down, acknowledging that he was in some way divine and worthy of honor and love and service, they were honoring him even by their presence. I mean, and I don't mean presence like the gifts. I mean their being there. You know, they made a long and arduous journey on foot or on camel to get there just to honor that baby. No other agenda. A number of years ago, one of Lori's best friends, a friend of many years, had a significant birthday. And she lives in Chicago. Well, Lori traveled to Chicago by herself just to be there to celebrate her friend's birthday. She certainly didn't go there because she had some big desire to see Chicago. She didn't go there because she wanted the thrill of the 4 or 5 hour plane ride each way. She went there for one reason, and that is to celebrate her friend. Her presence itself was honoring her friend. And that's true of the Magi. Their presence alone was honoring this child. They wouldn't do that for any other baby. You wouldn't travel that far for some random child. They went there because this baby was worthy of honor. They bowed down to him. They gave him gifts. And what I want you to remember is they had no other agenda for this entire thing other than to worship and honor that baby. They gained no power. They achieved no political goals. They received no personal advantage. They simply came to honor the baby. And that leads us to the last thing that happened. That's Herod. Herod tried to eliminate the king. The Magi came for a noble cause. There was nothing noble about Herod. Herod, as a human being, was a disaster. He actually killed some of his own family members, 3 sons and a wife, all because he thought they might be plotting against him to overthrow him. At one point, the nobles of Israel were opposing him, and so he arrested 45 of the most prominent people in Israel and had them all executed, and he took over all their money and all their lands. This guy was ruthless. And man, does that come out in this passage. He believed the arrival of this child with a legitimate claim to the throne of Israel was a clear and present danger, and he was not going to allow that to continue. Came up with a clever plot, you know, tell me where the baby is. Well, because he wants to go find the baby and kill the baby. And when he realizes he's been outmaneuvered by the Magi, he issues an order. That baby can't survive, so he sends troops to Bethlehem and says, kill every boy in that town under the age of 2. Horrific. It appalls me that Herod had people who would carry out such an order. Can you imagine people being willing to do that, to slaughter innocent children for no reason other than this man's paranoid ego? Apparently he had a goon squad that had pretty much lost every shred of human decency. What a horrific experience. What a terrible day. We don't know how many kids were killed. One scholar I read estimated it could have been in the range of as many as 40 or 50. We don't really know. What we can know is that some parents undoubtedly died too, because what parent is going to stand by and watch someone slaughter their child and do nothing? A quote from Jeremiah 31:15 would have been an understatement. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted. How do you comfort a parent who's gone through that experience? You know, the death of a child for parents is horrific. There's no way to explain the grief of it. But added to the grief for them had to be rage. Because this wasn't a child dying because of some act of God, some terrible disease. This was a child being killed by a monster for no reason. Last week, if you were here, we looked at Revelation 12 and we saw a picture of the spiritual warfare that goes on all day, all night, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Satan trying to lash out at and destroy God and God's work and anything having to do with God. And we saw in that passage that when the Messiah was born, Satan was right there and his desire was to destroy the Messiah before he made any impact in this world whatsoever. And this is what happened. This is Satan's first attempt to try to destroy Messiah and his work. This is Herod being a tool of Satan, thinking he was operating out of his own motivations and for his own ends. He, in fact, was being used by Satan in his attempt to destroy the Messiah. Of course, the good news was that God saw this coming, warned Joseph, get out of town fast. And that very night that he was given that message, he left, headed to Egypt. Yeah, you know, that's, we don't sing about that story in Christmas carols much, do we? What do we do with this? What can we take from this? Well, let me point out several things. First of all, spiritual war has victims. We saw last week, this was a time when Jesus was born where the spiritual war broke into the physical realm in a physical way. And this is what happens when that occurs. We should always remember that when the spiritual war breaks into this physical world, people get hurt. It's easy to forget that, but that is... this is a classic example of it. You know, sometimes we have difficulty. We hear about some of the horrible things that happen in this world. Last week, I mentioned the story of J.W. Tucker, who went to Africa as a missionary just to do good to people, and he ended up being killed for his efforts. And we sometimes say, why does that happen? Here's why that happens. It's because there's a war on. There's a spiritual war, and sometimes that spiritual war breaks into this physical world and people get physically hurt and even killed. Not long ago, I read the story, again, I've read it before, but the story of Karen Watson. Her story always catches my attention. She was a missionary, went to Iraq, and she catches my attention because she was from my hometown of Bakersfield. And while she was there, she and three others were just carrying out relief efforts. They're giving out relief supplies when insurgents drove by and opened fire with automatic weapons. She and two others were killed. We read that and we think, why? It's because there's a war on. There is a spiritual war on, and at times it breaks into this world and people get physically hurt. We look at Chinese authorities, which are currently being more aggressive again and persecuting churches, and we think, why does that happen? Why are Christians hurting and being imprisoned and beaten? It's because there's a war on. And we need to remember that. Because sometimes the spiritual war will break into this world and it won't be someone necessarily doing something as violent as what Herod did, but it will come out in physical ways the way it did in Job's life. Spiritual war broke out in his life, and it meant loss. Loss of loved ones, loss of wealth, loss of health. His life became a living hell because the spiritual war was going on. It's important for us to remember that, because sometimes we will be the ones who get hurt. And it's important for us to realize this is going to happen. In wars, people get hurt and people die. This spiritual war, it's not a pretend thing. Oh, this mythological thing, we talk about it, but it's not real. It's very real. And it has very real consequences in this world. And sometimes those consequences are innocent people get hurt and even killed. Wow, that's a great Christmas message, Rick. Yeah, hold on. So the second thing we need to remember is that we must trust God in the midst of it. You know, I think about those parents who lost a child at the hands of Herod's thugs. Those people had no idea what was going on. All they knew was something horrific, some unimaginable atrocity had taken from them something that was most precious. And that's all they knew. And they had no idea that what was really happening was there was a spiritual war going on, and God was making his greatest invasion. This was the pinnacle battle of the spiritual war, and they did not ever, most of them never knew that. Would that have changed how they felt? No, they still would have grieved. But, you know, you think about Job, same problem. He goes through these things, he has no idea why these things are happening. Why is all of this happening to me? And he didn't understand there's a war on. But here's the thing. Look at Job's response to it. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He didn't understand it. He didn't have the bigger picture, but he continued to trust. And that's what we need to do in the midst of the battle of this world. That when those things happen and we don't understand why they're happening, we need to remember, oh, I'm in a spiritual war, that's right. And what I need to do in the midst of this is trust God, because God is doing something bigger that I can't even see. The picture is way above my pay grade. It was for Job and it was for the people of Bethlehem. And it will be for us as well. We need to remember the magnificent but sometimes weird majesty of God. Have you noticed that in this story? You know, God says, okay, I choose Israel to be my people. And he says, here's some rules for you, Israel. Among them, one of the things is don't have anything to do with the occult, right? So now Messiah is born. God entering in this world, time to worship. And who worships him? Well, there's a handful of shepherds that were only there because they got told to go there by a bunch of angels, and when angels tell you to do something, you say, okay, I'm on my way. They go worship. But they're nobodies. They're nobodies. Where's the leadership of Israel? Where are the spiritual leaders? Where are the people of God coming in mass to worship their long-awaited Messiah? None of them there. Who shows up? A bunch of foreigners. A bunch of guys from a people group that is not God's chosen people. And not only that, but there are a bunch of guys who do things that God has specifically said you must not do. They major in doing things that God says, don't do that. And there they are, they're doing that. And here's the weirdest part. Not only do they major in that, God uses the things that he told them not to do to bring them to Israel to worship Messiah. Don't study the stars and do the astrology. And I'm going to give you a sign in the stars to send you to Israel. That is so weird, isn't it? I mean, it's just like, whoa, this is just strange. Because the whole thing about the Christmas story is God doing things in ways that we would never, ever do them. God entering, you know, human history as a man so he could die, you know. God being a baby, God being a baby being born in a barn, none of it makes it. God being born to a virgin, What human being is going to come up with that story? With that plan? None of us. And when we see that, we need to go, okay, you know what? God doesn't do things the way we would do them. In Romans 11:34, Paul wrote, "Who has known the mind of the Lord? Who has become the Lord's counselor?" Oh, well, actually, I have a number of times. I counsel God a lot in telling how life ought to go. Strangely, he doesn't listen very much. Kind of does things his own way. But Paul's point is, we don't know the mind of God. We don't know all of that. We don't understand why God does. And when he sees some of the things he does, it's like, wow, I don't get this. And yet, God's wisdom, or God's foolishness, is wiser than the wisdom of men. God is doing these things, and we don't always understand them, but what we need to do is be able to say, oh, but I know this. I know the character of God, and I know his goodness, and his love, and his righteousness, and his justice, and his holiness, and his love, and that's what guides everything he does. And in this plan that he's working that I don't always understand, I can trust him. So one last thing that we really, I think this is really the heart of what we need to get out of this. What matters is that Jesus be glorified. There is a very difficult question that occurs to me when I study this passage, and that it is this. Why did the Magi come? Because consider what would have happened if they hadn't. No Magi? Well, Jesus still would have been born. He still would have been the Son of God. He still would have been able to, do his ministry and live. All of that would have, none of that would have changed if the Magi had never been there. One thing would have changed if the Magi had never come. Herod would never have known about it, and those children would never have been killed. Right? No Magi, no slaughter of the innocents. Why? Why did that happen? Why would God do such a thing? Bring those guys to come and talk to Herod so Herod now knows, and Herod goes, man, I don't get that. Well, that's because I don't know the mind of the Lord. But there's one thing that's apparent in this incident. I think we need to say, this is an example of the weird majesty of God, his weird wisdom that we're not always going to comprehend and we have to trust. But here's what's apparent in this. God went to a lot of trouble to get those men there so that Jesus could be worshipped. He knew his people weren't going to worship him. And so he brought some other people there to worship him. And I think there's some reasons for why those other people came from far away. I think that they came because Jesus, or God knew that if Israel had come to worship Messiah, why would they have been worshiping him? Well, because he was going to be their king. He was going to knock off the Romans and make Israel powerful, and their lives were going to get better right now, and that's all they would have cared about. Right? That's what Israel was about. Power, better life right now. And God's saying, no, I'm doing something way bigger than that. And so instead, he brings a group of people to worship the Messiah, people who have nothing to gain from doing it. Nothing. But honor him just because of who he is. And there's a message in their coming. Here's a group of people from a foreign land. What does that say? This Messiah isn't just for Israel. It's for all people. He's for all people. He's the ruler of all, not just of Israel. And furthermore, these are people who, by their lives, their choices, they're not acceptable to God. And yet they're given the grace to come to Messiah. And it's a message that, hey, you know what? This Messiah is bringing grace so that people who are unacceptable, people who cannot measure up, are suddenly going to be acceptable to God. Their very presence speaks of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But here's the thing. They're there to glorify Jesus because Jesus, as the Son of God, is worthy of worship, and he needs to be glorified even at the risk of great harm. Even at the risk of children being slaughtered, it's important that Jesus Christ be glorified. Wow, that's hard for us to swallow, isn't it? But what does that say if that's true? That says the failure to honor Christ is a greater tragedy than even the loss of innocent children. That it in fact is a greater evil than the loss of innocent children. Which is hard for us to imagine, but we need to think back. Romans chapter 1, verse 21 says, here's how the human condition came about. People knew about God and refused to honor him as God or give thanks to him. And their foolish hearts became darkened. And the whole mess of the human condition was the result. All of the evil that we see, all of the sorrow, all of the pain and the misery that you see in this world, all came from the failure to glorify the one who rules over all. That's the message. When I make a choice in my own life to pursue my will and my desires over honoring and glorifying Christ, I am bringing about a catastrophe at a level that I cannot even imagine. There are ripples that are going to come out from that are going to affect everyone around me. That the ultimate, most important thing in life is to honor Jesus Christ above all else. Before his death, writer David Foster Wallace gave a famous speech. And in it, he said to graduates, at a graduation speech, he said this: in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. Pretty much anything you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. If you don't believe that, go up to Hollywood and look at some of the actresses and what they've done to their faces and go, ooh. Worship your intellect. Being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. He's right. We're going to worship. It's part of human nature. We can't help it. We're going to worship someone or something. If you worship anything other than the true good, the true object of worship, it will eat you alive, and it will create unbelievable evil in this world. The presence of the Magi at the home of Jesus, the high cost of their visit, says the most important thing you can do in life is to worship Jesus Christ. Make it the driving force of every single thing we do. The motivation behind every act, every word we say, should be to glorify Jesus Christ. In the movie Walk the Line, which stars Joaquin Phoenix as Johnny Cash, tells the story of Johnny Cash's life. Early in the movie, there's a scene where Cash is trying to get started in the music industry, and he's got two guys, they make a band, the three of them, and they're auditioning for a record contract before studio executive Sam Phillips. And they're performing, they're kind of the southern guys, so they've got sort of a gospel song, and they're performing this country gospel song and sort of doing it in a kind of emotionless manner. And halfway through, Phillips just stops them and says, "Have you got anything else?" And Cash asks, "Well, what's wrong with that?" And he says, I can't sell gospel music like that." And Cash says, "Well, is it the gospel or is it the way I sing it?" And Phillips says, "Well, it's both." Cash says, "Well," he objects, he says, "Well, you didn't let us bring it home." And then Phillips says this in some disbelief, "Bring it home? You want to bring it home? All right, let's bring it home." He says this: if you was hit by a truck and you're lying out in the gutter dying and you had time just to sing one song people would remember before your dirt, one song that would let God know what you felt about your time here on earth, one song that would sum you up, are you telling me that's the song you'd sing? Or would you sing something different? Something real, something you really felt. Because I'm telling you right now, that's the kind of song people want to hear. That's the kind of song that truly saves people. What's your song that you sing? Our song, if we want to have life and if we want to bring life to other people, the song needs to be a song of praise to Jesus Christ in everything we are and everything we do. So before we sing a song, let's pray. Father, strange, upsetting, disturbing story this morning that we've looked at from your word. And yet, we remember these things happened in real life, real history, horrifying things. The spiritual war arriving on our shores, and the results were horrific. Lord, we thank you for the reminder of this is what Satan wants for us and for everyone who follows Christ. He's out to destroy. But we thank you, Father, that you protect us. And most of all, we realize again that what's important here, above all else, is that Jesus Christ be glorified. Help us, Lord, in our individual lives to remember that truth, to orient everything we are and everything we do around honoring Jesus Christ as Lord of all, Lord of our lives, Lord of the universe. We thank you, Father. Amen.